His teat to feed what waited inside. It flew past him, dividing as it went, going to a dozen places around the room, high and low. Then the handles were snatched from Gentle's grip, and the doors slammed. He turned back to face the room, and as he did so, heard the table being thrown over. Some of the light had been drawn to what lay beneath. There was Godolphin, gutted, his entrails splayed around him, his kidneys laid on his eyes, his heart at his groin, and skittering around his body. Some of the entities this arrangement had called forth, carrying fragments of the light stolen through the door. None of them made much sense to Gentle's eye. They had no limbs recognisable as such, nor any trace of features, nor in most cases heads upon which features might have sat. They were scraps of nonsense, some strung together like the cloggings of a drain, and mindlessly busy, others lying like bloated fruit, splitting and showing themselves seedless. Gentle looked towards Sartori. He hadn't taken any light for himself, but a loop of wormy life hung over his head and cast its baleful brightness down.
"What have you done?" Gentle asked him.
"There are workings a reconciler would never stoop to know. This is one. These beasts are oviats, peripeteria. You can't raise the weightier beasts with a corpse that's cold, but these things know how to be compliant, and that's all either you or I have ever really asked for from our abettors, isn't it? Or from our loved ones, come to that."
"Well, you've shown me them now,"
Gentle said. "You can send them home."
"Oh, no, brother. I want you to know what they can do. They're the least of the least, but they've got some maddening tricks."
Sartori glanced up, and the loop of wretchedness above him went from its cherished place, moving towards Gentle, then to the ground, its target not the living, but the dead. It was around Godolphin's neck in moments, while in the air above it an alliance of its fellows formed, congealing into a peristaltic cloud. The loop tightened like a noose and rose, hauling Godolphin up. The kidneys fell from his eyes. They were open beneath. The heart dropped from his groin. There was a wound where his manhood had been. Then the remaining innards spilled from his carcass, preserved in a jelly of cold blood. The peripeteria overhead offered themselves as a gallows for the ascending noose, and, having it in their midst, rose again, so that the dead man's feet were pulled clear off the ground.
"This is obscene, Sartori," Gentle said. "Stop it.
It's not very pretty, is it? But think, brother, think what an army of them could do. You couldn't even heal this single little horror, never mind this a thousandfold."
He paused, then said with genuine inquiry in his voice,
"Or could you?
Could you raise poor Oscar?
From the dead, I mean. Could you do that?"
He left his place at the other end of the room and moved towards Gentle, the look on his face, lit by the gallows, one of exhilaration at this possibility.
"If you could do that," he said, "I swear I'd be your perfect disciple. I would."
He was past the hanged man now and coming within a yard or two of Gentle.
"I swear," he said again.
"Let him down."
"Why?"
"Because it's pointless and pathetic."
"Maybe that's what I am," Sartori said. "Maybe that's what I've been from the beginning, and I never had the wit to realize it."
This was a new tack, Gentle thought. 5 minutes before, the man had been demanding due respect as an aspirant messiah. Now he was wallowing in self-abnegation.
"I've had so many dreams, brother. Oh, the cities I've imagined. The empires. But I could never quite remove the niggling doubt, you know? The worm at the back of the skull that keeps saying, it'll come to nothing, it'll come to nothing. And you know what? The worm was right. All I ever attempted was doomed from the beginning because of what we are to each other."
"Tragic," Clem had said, describing the look on Sartori's face as he'd fled the cellar. And perhaps in his way he was. But what had he learned that had brought him so low? It had to be goaded out of him, now or never.
"I saw your empire,"
Gentle replied.
It didn't fall apart because there was some judgment on it. You built it out of shit. That's why it collapsed.
But don't you see, that was the judgment. I was the architect, and I was also the judge who found it unworthy. I was set against myself from the beginning, and I never realized it.
But you realize it now?
It couldn't be plainer.
Why? Do you see yourself in this filth? Is that it?
No, brother, Sartori said. It's when I look at you.
At me? Sartori stared at him, tears beginning to fill his eyes.
She thought I was you, he murmured.
Judith?
Celestine! She didn't know there were two of us. How could she? So when she saw me, she was pleased. At first, anyway.
There was a weight of pain in his speech that Gentle hadn't anticipated, and it was no pretense. Sartori was suffering like a damned man.
Then she smelled me, he went on. She said I stank of evil and I disgusted her.
Why should you care? Gentle said. You wanted to kill her anyway.
No, he protested. That wasn't what I wanted at all. I wouldn't have laid a finger on her if she hadn't attacked me.
You're suddenly very loving.
Of course!
I don't see why.
Didn't you say we were brothers?
Yes.
Then she's my mother, too. Don't I have some right to be loved by her?
Mother?
Yes, mother. She's your mother, Gentle. She was raped by the unbeheld, and you're the consequence.
Gentle was too shocked to reply. His mind was gathering puzzles from far and wide, all of them solved by this revelation, and the solving filled him to brimming. Sartori wiped his face with the heels of his hands.
I was born to be the devil, brother, he said. Hell to your heaven, do you see? Every plan I ever laid, every ambition I ever had is a mockery, because the part of me that's you wants love and glory and great works, and the part of me that's our father knows it's shite and brings it down. I'm my own destroyer, brother. All I can do is live with destruction until the end of the world.
2. In the foyer, 6 stories below, Celestine's rescuers had, after much coaxing, persuaded the woman out of the labyrinth and into the light. Weak though she'd been when Clem had entered her cell, she'd resisted his consolations for a good while, telling him that she wanted no part of them. She preferred to remain underground, she said, and perish there. His experience on the streets had given him away with such recalcitrance. He didn't argue with her, nor did he leave. He bided his time at the threshold, telling her she was probably right. There was nothing to be gained from seeing the sun. After a while she balked at this, telling him that wasn't her opinion at all, and if he had any decency about him, he'd give her some comfort in her distress. Did he want her to die like an animal, she said, locked away in the dark? He then allowed that the fault was his, and if she wanted to be taken up into the outside world, he'd do what he could. With his tactic successful, he sent Monday off to bring Jude's car to the front of the tower and began the business of getting Celestine out. There was a delicate moment at the door of the cell when the woman, setting eyes on Jude, almost recanted her desire to leave, saying she wanted no truck with this tainted creature. Jude kept her silence, and Clem, tact personified, sent her up to fetch blankets from the car while he escorted Celestine to the stairs. It was a slow business, and several times she asked him to stop, holding on to him fiercely and telling him that she wasn't trembling because she was afraid, but because her body was unused to such freedom, and that if anybody, particularly the tainted woman, was to remark on these tremors, he was to hush them. Thus, clinging to Clem one moment, then demanding he not lean on her the next, slowing at times, then rising up with preternatural strength in her sinews the instant after, Roxburgh's captive quit her prison after 2 centuries of incarceration and went up to meet the day. But the tower's sum of surprises, whether above or below, was not yet exhausted. As Clem escorted her across the foyer, he stopped, his eyes on the door ahead, or rather on the sunlight that poured through it.
It was laden with motes, pollen and seeds from the trees and plants outside, dust from the road beyond. Though there was scarcely a breeze outside, they were in lively motion.
"We've got a visitor," he remarked.
"Here?"
Jude said.
"Up ahead."
She looked at the light. Though she could see nothing that resembled a human form in it, the particles were not moving arbitrarily. There was some organizing principle among them, and Clem, it seemed, knew its name.
"Taylor,"
he said, his voice thick with feeling.
"Taylor's here."
He glanced across at Monday, who, without being told, stepped in to take Celestine's weight. The woman had been hovering on unconsciousness again, but now she raised her head and watched, as did they all, while Clem started to walk towards the light-filled door.
"It's you, isn't it?"
he said softly. In reply, the motion in the light became more agitated.
"I thought so,"
Clem said, coming to a halt a couple of yards from the edge of the pool.
"What does he want?"
Jude said.
"Can you tell?"
Clem glanced back at her, his expression both awed and afraid.
"He wants me to let him in," he replied. "He wants to be here."
He tapped his chest.
"Inside me."
Jude smiled. The day had brought little in the way of good news, but here was some. The possibility of a union she'd never have believed possible. Still, Clem hesitated, keeping his distance from the light.
"I don't know if I can do it," he said.
"He's not going to hurt you," Jude said.
"I know,"
Clem said, glancing back at the light. Its gilded dust was more hectic than ever.
"It's not the hurt."
"What then?"
He shook his head.
"I did it, man,"
Monday said.
"Just close your eyes and think of England."
This earned a little laugh from Clem, who was still staring at the light when Jude voiced the final persuasion.
"You loved him," she said.
The laugh caught in Clem's throat, and in the utter hush that followed he murmured,
"I still do."
"Then be with him."
He looked back at her one last time and smiled. Then he stepped into the light. To Jude's eyes there was nothing so remarkable about the sight. It was just a door, and a man stepping through it into sunlight. But there was significance in it now she'd never understood before, and as she stood witness, a warning of Oscar's returned to her head, spoken as they'd prepared to leave for his Isordrex. She'd come back changed, he'd said, seeing the world she'd left with clearer eyes. Here was proof of that. Perhaps sunlight had always been numinous, and doorways signs of a greater passage than that of one room to another, but she'd not seen it until now. Clem stood in the beams for perhaps 30 seconds, his hands palm up in front of him. Then he turned back towards her, and she saw that Taylor had come with him. If she'd been asked to name the places where she saw his presence, she couldn't have done so. There was no change in his physiognomy, no particular in which they could be seen, unless it was in signs so subtle, the angle of his head, the fixedness of his mouth, that she couldn't distinguish them. But he was there, no doubt of it. And so was an urgency that had not been in Clem a minute before.
"Take Celestine out of here," he said to Jude and Monday. "There's something terrible going on upstairs."
He left the doorway, heading for the stairs.
"Do you want help?"
Jude said.
"No, stay with her, she needs you."
At this, Celestine uttered her first words since leaving the cell.
"I don't need her," she said.
Clem reeled around on one heel, coming back to the woman and putting his nose an inch from hers.
"You know, I'm finding you hard to like, madam,"
he snapped. Jude laughed out loud, hearing Tay's irascible tones so clearly. She'd forgotten how his and Clem's natures had dovetailed before sickness had taken the piss and vinegar out of Tay.
"We are here because of you, remember that," Tay said, "and you'd still be down there picking the fluff from your navel if Judy hadn't brought us."
Celestine narrowed her eyes.
"Put me back, then," she said.
"Just for that?"
Jude held her breath. He wouldn't, surely.
"I'm going to give you a big kiss and ask you very politely to stop being a cantankerous old bag."
He kissed her on the nose. "Now let's get going," he said to Monday. And before Celestine could summon a reply, he headed to the stairs and was up them and out of sight. 3. Exhausted by his outpouring of pain, Sartori turned from Gentle and began to wander back to the chair where he'd been sitting at the start of their interview. He idled as he went, kicking over those servile scraps that came to dote on him, and pausing to look up at Godolphin's gutted body, then setting it in motion with a touch, so that its bulk eclipsed and uncovered him by turns as he went to his little throne. There were peripeteria gathered around in a sycophantic horde, but Gentle didn't wait for him to order them against him. Sartori was no less dangerous for the despair he just expressed. All it did was free him from any last hope of peace between them. It freed Gentle, too. This had to end in Sartori's dispatch, or the devil he'd decided to be would undo the great work all over again. Gentle drew breath. As soon as his brother turned, he'd let the pneuma fly and be done. "What makes you think you can kill me, brother?" Sartori said, still not turning. "God's in the First Dominion, and Mother's nearly dead downstairs. You're alone. All you have is your breath." Godolphin's body continued to swing between them, but the man kept his back turned. "And if you unknit me, what do you do to yourself in the process? Have you thought about that? Kill me, and maybe you kill yourself." Gentle knew Sartori was capable of planting such doubts all night. It was the complement to his own lost skill with seduction, dropping these possibilities into promising earth. He wouldn't be delayed by them. His pneuma readied, he started after the man, pausing only for the swing of Godolphin's corpse, then stopping on the other side of it. Sartori still refused to show his face, and Gentle had no option but to waste a little of the killing breath with words. "Look at me, brother," he said. He read the intention to do so in Sartori's body, a motion beginning in his heels and torso and head. But before his face came in sight, Gentle heard a sound behind him and glanced back to see the third actor here, the dead Godolphin, dropping from his gallows. He had time to glimpse the oviats in the carcass. Then it was upon him. It should have been easy to stand aside, but the beasts had done more than nest in the corpse. They were busy in Godolphin's rotted muscle, engineering the resurrection Sartori had begged Gentle to perform. The corpse's arms snatched hold of him, and its bulk, all the vaster for the weight of parasites, bore him to his knees. The breath went out of him as harmless air, and before he could take another, his arms were caught and twisted to breaking point behind his back. "Never turn your back on a dead man," Sartori said, finally showing his face. There was no triumph on it, though he'd incapacitated his enemy in one swift manoeuvre. He turned his sorrowful eyes up to the host of peripeteria that had been Godolphin's gallows, and with the thumb of his left hand described a tiny circle. They took their cue instantly, the motion appearing in their cloud. "I'm more superstitious than you, brother," Sartori said, reaching behind him and throwing over his chair. It didn't lie where it fell, but rolled on around the room, as though the motion overhead had some correspondence below. "I'm not going to lay a hand on you," he went on, "in case there is some consequence for a man who takes his other's life." He raised his palms. "Look, I'm blameless," he said, stepping back towards the draped windows. "You're going to die because the world is coming apart." While he spoke, the motion around Gentle increased as the peripeteria took their summoner's cue. They were insubstantial as individuals, but en masse they had considerable authority. As their circling speeded up, it generated a current strong enough to lift the chair Sartori had overthrown into the air. The light fixtures were sheared off the walls, taking cobs of plaster with them. The handles were ripped from the doors, and the rest of the chairs snatched up to join the tarantella, smashed to firewood as they collided with each other. Even the table, enormous as it was, began to move. At the eye of this storm, Gentle struggled to free himself from Godolphin's cold embrace. He might have done so, given time, but the circle and its freight of shards closed on him too quickly. Unable to protect himself, all he could do was bow his head against the hail of wood, plaster and glass, the breath pummeled from him by the assault. Only once did he lift his eyes to look for Sartori through the storm. His brother stood flat against the wall, his head thrown back as he watched the execution. If there was any feeling on his face, it was that of a man offended by what he saw. A lamb obliged to watch helplessly as his companion was pulped. It seemed he didn't hear the voice raised in the corridor outside, but Gentle did. It was Clem, calling the maestro's name and beating on the door. Gentle didn't have the strength left to reply. His body sagged in Godolphin's arms as the fusillade increased, striking his skull and ribcage and thighs. Clem, God love him, didn't need an answering call. He slammed himself against the door repeatedly, and the lock suddenly burst, throwing both doors open at once. There was more light outside than in, of course, and just as before, it was drawn into the darkened room at a rush, sweeping past the astonished Clem. The peripeteria were as desperate as ever to have a sliver of illumination for themselves, and their swirling ranks fell into confusion at the appearance of the light. Gentle felt the hold on him loosen, as those Oviats who'd quickened Godolphin's corpse left off their labours and went to join the melee. With the energies in the room diverted, the circling wreckage began to lose momentum, but not before a piece of the splintered table struck one of the open doors, shearing it off at the hinges. Clem saw the collision coming and retreated before he too was struck, his shout of alarm stirring Sartori. Gentle looked towards his brother. He'd left off his sham of innocence and was studying the stranger in the hallway with gleaming eyes. He didn't leave his place at the wall, however. A rain of wreckage was falling now, littering the room from end to end, and he clearly had no desire to step into it. Instead, he reached up to snatch a Yurido from his eye, intending to strike Clem down before he could intervene again. Godolphin's bulk was doubling Gentle over, but he strained to raise himself from beneath it, yelling a warning to Clem, who was back at the threshold now, as he did so. Clem heard the shout and saw Sartori snatch at his eye. Though he had no knowledge of what the gesture meant, he was quick to defend himself, ducking behind the surviving door as the killing blow flew his way. In the same instant, Gentle heaved himself to his feet, throwing off Godolphin's body. He glanced in Clem's direction to be certain his friend had survived, and, seeing that he had, started towards Sartori. He had breath in his body now, and might easily have dispatched a numerate his enemy, but his hands wanted more than air in them. They wanted flesh. They wanted bone. Careless of the trash that was both underfoot and falling from the air, he ran at his brother, who sensed his approach and turned his way. Gentle had time to see the face before him smile a feral welcome, then he was upon him. His momentum carried them both back against the drapes. The window behind Sartori shattered and the rail above him broke, bringing the curtain down. This time the light that filled the room was ablaze, and it fell directly on Gentle's face. He was momentarily blinded, but his body still knew its business. He pushed his brother to the sill and hauled him up over it. Sartori reached for a handhold and snatched at the fallen drape, but its folds were of little use. The cloth tore as he tipped backwards, carried over the sill by his brother's arms. Even then he fought to keep himself from falling, but Gentle gave him no quarter. Sartori flailed for a moment, scrabbling at the air, then he was gone from Gentle's hands, his scream going with him, down and down and down. Gentle didn't see the fall and was glad of it. Only when the cry stopped did he retreat from the window and cover his face, while the circle of the sun blazed blue and green and red behind his lids. When he finally opened his eyes, it was to devastation. The only whole thing in the room was Clem, and even he was the worse for wear. He'd picked himself up and was watching the Oviats, who'd fought so vehemently for a piece of light, withering for excess of it. Their matter was drab slough, their skitters and flights reduced to a wretched, crawling retreat from the window. "I've seen prettier turds," Clem remarked. Then he started around the room, pulling all the rest of the drapes down, the dust he raised making the sun solid as it came, and leaving no shadow for the peripeteria to retreat to. "Taylor's here," he said when the job was done.
"In the sun?"
"Better than that," Clem replied. "In my head.
We think you need guardian angels, Maestro.
So do I, said Gentle. Thank you. Both.
He turned back to the window and looked down at the wasteland into which Sartori had fallen. He didn't expect to see a body there, nor did he. Sartori hadn't survived all those years as Ortak without finding 100 fates to protect his flesh. They met Monday, who had heard the window breaking above, coming up the stairs as they descended.
I thought you was a goner, boss, he said.
Almost, came the reply.
What do we do about Godolphin? Clem said as the trio headed down together.
We don't need to do anything, Gentle said. There's an open window.
I don't think he's going to be flying anywhere.
No, but the birds can get to him, Gentle said lightly. Better to fatten birds than worms.
There's a morbid sense in that, I suppose, Clem said.
And how's Celestine? Gentle asked the boy.
She's in the car, all wrapped up and not saying very much. I don't think she likes the sun.
After 200 years in the dark, I'm not surprised. We'll make her comfortable once we get to Gamut Street. She's a great lady, gentlemen.
She's also my mother. So that's where you get your bloody-mindedness from, Tay remarked. How safe is this house we're going to? Monday asked.
If you mean how do we stop Sartori getting in, I don't think we can. They'd reached the foyer, which was as sun-filled as ever.
So what do you think the bastard's going to do? Clem wondered.
He won't come back here, I'm sure of that, Gentle said. I think he'll wander the city for a while. But sooner or later he'll be driven back to where he belongs.
Which is where?
Gentle opened his arms.
Here, he said.
Chapter 16 1 There was surely no more haunted thoroughfare in London that blistering afternoon than Gamut Street. Neither those locations in the city famous for their phantoms, nor those anonymous spots, known only to psychics and children, where revenants gathered, boasted more souls eager to debate events in the place of their decease as that backwater in Clerkenwell. While few human eyes, even those ready for the marvellous, and the car that turned into Gamut Street at a little past 4 o'clock contained several such eyes, could see the phantoms as solid entities, their presence was clear enough, marked by the cold, still places in the shimmering haze rising off the road, and by the stray dogs that gathered in such numbers at the corners, drawn by the high whistle some of the dead were wont to make. Thus, Gamut Street cooked in a heat of its own, its stew potent with spirits. Gentle had warned them all that there was no comfort to be had at the house. It was without furniture, water, or electricity. But the past was there, he said, and it would be a comfort to them all after their time in the enemy's tower.
I remember this house, Jude said as she emerged from the car.
We should both be careful, Gentle warned as he climbed the steps. Sartori left one of his oviats inside, and it nearly drove me crazy. I want to get rid of it before we all go in.
I'm coming with you,
Jude said, following him to the door.
I don't think that's wise, he said. Let me deal with Little Ease first.
That's Sartori's beast?
Yes.
Then I'd like to see it. Don't worry, it's not going to hurt me. I've got a little of its maestro right here, remember?
She laid her hand upon her belly.
I'm safe.
Gentle made no objection, but stood aside to let Monday force the door, which he did with the efficiency of a practiced thief. Before the boy had even retreated down the steps again, Jude was over the threshold, braving the stale, cold air.
Wait up, Gentle said, following her into the hallway.
What does this creature look like?
She wanted to know.
Like an ape. Or a baby, I don't know. It talks a lot, I'm certain of that much.
Little Ease.
That's right.
Perfect name for a place like this.
She'd reached the bottom of the stairs and was staring up towards the meditation room.
Be careful, Gentle said.
I heard you the first time.
I don't think you quite understand how powerful—
I was born up there, wasn't I?
She said, her tone as chilly as the air. He didn't reply, not until she swung around and asked him again.
Wasn't I?
Yes. Nodding, she returned to her study of the stairs.
You said the past was waiting here, she said.
Yes.
My past, too?
I don't know, probably.
I don't feel anything. It's like a bloody graveyard. A few vague recollections, that's all.
They'll come.
You're very certain.
We have to be whole, Jude.
What do you mean by that?
We have to be reconciled with everything we ever were before we can go on.
Suppose I don't want to be reconciled. Suppose I want to invent myself all over again, starting now.
You can't do it, he said simply. We have to be whole before we can get home.
If that's home, she said, nodding in the direction of the meditation room, you can keep it.
I don't mean the cradle.
What then?
The place before the cradle. Heaven.
Fuck heaven. I haven't got Earth sorted out yet.
You don't need to.
Let me be the judge of that. I haven't even had a life I could call my own, and you're ready to slot me into the grand design. Well, I don't think I want to go. I want to be my own design.
You can be, as part of...
Part of nothing. I want to be me, a law unto myself.
That isn't you talking. It's Sartori.
What if it is?
You know what he's done, Gentle replied. The atrocities.
What are you doing taking lessons from him? When I should be taking them from you, you mean? Since when were you so damn perfect?
He made no reply, and she took his silence as further sign of his new high-mindedness.
Oh, so you're not going to stoop to mudslinging, is that it?
We'll debate it later, he said.
Debate it? She mocked. What are you going to give us, maestro, an ethics lesson? I want to know what makes you so damn rare.
I'm Celestine's son, he said quietly. She stared at him, agog.
You're what?
Celestine's son. She was taken from the fifth.
I know where she was taken. Dowd did it. I thought he'd told me the whole story.
Not this part?
Not this part.
There were kinder ways to tell you. I'm sorry I didn't find one.
No, she said. Where better?
Her gaze went back up the stairs. When she spoke again, which was not for a little time, it was in a whisper.
You're lucky, she said. Home and heaven are the same place.
Maybe that's true for us all, he murmured.
I doubt it.
A long silence followed, punctuated only by Monday's forlorn attempts to whistle on the step outside. At last, Jude said,
I can see now why you're so desperate to get all this right. You're... How does it go? You're about your father's business.
I hadn't thought of it quite like that.
But you are.
I suppose I am. I just hope I'm equal to it, that's all. One minute I feel it's all possible, the next...
He studied her,
while outside, Monday attempted the tune afresh. Tell me what you're thinking, he said.
I'm thinking I wish I'd kept your love letters, she replied.
There was another aching pause. Then she turned from him and wandered off towards the back of the house. He lingered at the bottom of the stairs, thinking he should probably go with her, in case Sartori's agent was hiding there, but he was afraid to bruise her further with his scrutiny. He glanced back towards the open door and the sunlight on the step. Safety wasn't far from her if she needed it.
How's it going? He called to Monday.
Hot, came the reply. Clem's going to fetch some food and beer. Lots of beer. We should have a party, boss. We fucking deserve it, don't we?
We do. How's Celestine?
She's asleep. Is it okay to come in yet?
Just a little while longer, Gentle replied. But keep up the whistling, will you? There's a tune in there somewhere.
Monday laughed, and the sound, which was utterly commonplace, of course, yet as unlikely as whale song, pleased him. If little Ease was still in the house, Gentle thought, his malice could do no great harm on a day as miraculous as this. Comforted, he set off up the stairs, wondering as he went if perhaps the daylight had shooed all the memories into hiding. But before he was halfway up the flight, he had proof that they hadn't. The phantom form of Lucius Cobbett, conjured in his mind's eye, appeared beside him, snotty, tearful, and desperate for wisdom. Moments later, the sound of his own voice, offering the advice he'd given the boy that last, terrible night. "Study nothing except in the knowledge that you already knew it. Worship nothing." But before he'd completed the second dictum, the phrase was taken up by a mellifluous voice from above.
"Accept in adoration of your true self, and fear nothing."
The figment of Lucius Cobbett faded as Gentle continued to climb, but the voice became louder.
"Accept in the certainty that you are your enemy's begetter, and its only hope of healing."
And with the voice came the realization that the wisdom he'd bestowed on Lucius had not been his at all. It had originated with the mischief. The door to the meditation room was open, and Pi was perched on the sill, smiling out of the past.
"When did you invent that?" the maestro asked.
"I didn't invent it. I learned it," the mischief replied, "from my mother. And she learned it from her mother. Or her father. Who knows? Now you can pass it on."
"And what am I?"
he asked the mischief.
"Your son or your daughter?"
Pi looked almost abashed.
"You're my maestro."
"Is that all? We're still masters and servants here?"
"Don't say that." "What should I say?"
"What you feel."
"Oh," the mischief smiled. "If I told you what I feel, we'd be here all day."
The gleam of mischief in its eye was so endearing, and the memory so real, it was all Gentle could do to prevent himself crossing the room and embracing the space where his friend had sat. But there was work to be done, his father's business, as Jude had called it, and it was more pressing than indulging his memories. When little Ease had been ousted from the house, then he'd return here and search for a profounder lesson, that of the workings of the reconciliation. He needed that education quickly, and the echoes here were surely rife with exchanges on the subject.
"I'll be back," he said to the creature on the sill.
"I'll be waiting," it replied.
He glanced back towards it, and the sun, catching the window behind, momentarily ate into its silhouette, showing him not a whole figure but a fragment. His gut turned as the image called another back to mind with appalling force, the erasure in roiling chaos, and in the air above his head the howling rags of his beloved returned into the second with some words of warning.
"Undone," it had said as it fought the claim of the erasure. "We are undone."
Had he made some placating reply, snatched from his lips by the storm? He didn't remember. But he heard again the mischief telling him to find Sartori, instructing him that his other knew something that he, Gentle, didn't. And then it had gone, been snatched away into the first dominion, and silenced there. His heart racing, Gentle shook this horror from his head and looked back towards the sill. It was empty now, but Pi's exhortation to find Sartori was still in his head. Why had that been so important, he wondered. Even if the mischief had somehow discovered the truth of Gentle's origins in the First Dominion and had failed to communicate the fact, it must have known that Sartori was as much in ignorance of the secret as his brother. So what was the knowledge the mischief had believed Sartori possessed, that it had defied the limits of God's kingdom to spur him into pursuit? A shout from below had him give up the enigma. Jude was calling out to him. He headed down the stairs at speed, following her voice through the house and into the kitchen, which was large and chilly. Jude was standing close to the window, which had gone to ruin many years ago, giving access to the convolvulus from the garden behind, which, having entered, had rotted in a darkness its own abundance had thickened. The sun could only get pencil beams through this snare of foliage and wood, but they were sufficient to illuminate both the woman and the captive whose head she had pinned beneath her foot. It was little Ease, his oversized mouth drawn down like a tragic mask, his eyes turned up towards Jude.
"Is this it?" she said.
"This is it."
Little Ease set up a round of thin mewling as Gentle approached, which it turned into words.
"I didn't do a thing. You ask her, please, ask her. Did I do a thing? No, I didn't. Just keeping out of harm's way I was."
"Sartori's not very happy with you," Gentle said.
"Well, I didn't have a hope.
it protested. "Not against the likes of you, not against a reconciler."
"So you know that much?"
"I do now."
"We have to be whole,"
it quoted, catching Gentle's tone perfectly.
"We have to be reconciled with everything we ever were."
"You were listening."
"I can't help it,"
the creature said.
"I was born inquisitive. I didn't understand it, though,"
it hastened to add.
"I'm not spying, I swear."
"Liar,"
Jude said. Then to Gentle.
"How do we kill it?"
"We don't have to,"
he said. "Are you afraid, little Ease?"
"What do you think?"
"Would you swear allegiance to me if you were allowed to live?"
"Where do I sign? Show me the place."
"You'd let this live,"
Jude said.
"Yes."
"What for?"
she demanded, grinding her heel upon it.
"Look at it."
"Don't,"
little Ease begged.
"Swear," said Gentle, going down on his haunches beside it.
"I swear, I swear."
Gentle looked up at Jude. "Lift your foot," he said.
"You trust it?"
"I don't want death here," he said. "Even this. Let it go, Jude."
She didn't move.
"I said let it go."
Reluctance in every sinew, she raised her foot half an inch and little Ease scrabbled free, instantly taking hold of Gentle's hand.
"I'm yours, Liberatore,"
it said, touching its clammy brow to Gentle's palm.
"My head's in your hands. By Hio, by Herite, by Hapex Amendios, I commit my heart to you."
"Accepted," Gentle said and stood up.
"What should I do now, Liberatore?"
"There's a room at the top of the stairs. Wait for me there."
"Forever and ever."
"A few minutes will do."
It backed off to the door, bowing woozily, then took to its heels.
"How can you trust a thing like that?"
Jude said.
"I don't. Not yet."
"But you're willing to try."
"You're damned if you can't forgive, Jude."
"You could forgive Sartori, could you?"
she said.
"He's me. He's my brother. And he's my child," Gentle replied. "How could I not?"
2. With the house made safe, the rest of the company moved in. Monday, ever the scavenger, went off to scour the neighbouring houses and streets in search of whatever he could find to offer some modicum of comfort. He returned 3 times with Bounty, the 3rd time taking Clem off with him. They returned 30 minutes later with 2 mattresses and armfuls of bed linen, all too clean to have been found abandoned.
"I missed my vocation," Clem said, with Tay's mischief in his features. "Burglary's much more fun than banking."
At this juncture, Monday requested permission to borrow Jude's car and drive back to the South Bank, there to collect the belongings he'd left behind in his haste to follow Gentle. She told him yes, but urged him to return as fast as possible. Though it was still bright on the street outside, they would need as many strong arms and wills as they could muster to defend the house when night fell. Clem had settled Celestine in what had been the dining room, laying the larger of the 2 mattresses on the floor and sitting with her until she slept. When he emerged, Tay's feisty presence was mellowed, and the man who came to join Jude on the step was serene.
"Is she asleep?"
Jude asked him.
"I don't know if it's sleep or a coma. Where's Gentle?" "Upstairs, plotting."
"You've argued."
"That's nothing new. Everything else changes, but that remains the same."
He opened one of the bottles of beer sitting on the step and drank with gusto.
"You know, I catch myself every now and then wondering if this is all some hallucination. You've probably got a better grasp of it than I have. You've seen the Dominions, you know it's all real. But when I went off with Monday to get the mattresses, there were people just a few streets away, walking around in the sun as though it was just another day, and I thought, there's a woman back there who's been buried alive for 200 years, and her son, whose father's a god I never heard of."
"So he told you that?"
"Oh, yes. Thinking about it, I wanted to just go home, lock the door, and pretend it wasn't happening."
"What stopped you?"
"Monday, mostly. He just takes everything in stride. And knowing Tay's inside me, though that feels so natural,
It's like he was always there. Maybe he was, she said. Is there any more beer?
Yep. He handed over a bottle and she struck it on the step the way he had. The top flew, the beer foamed.
So what made you want to run?
She said when she'd slaked her thirst.
I don't know, Clem replied. Fear of what's coming, I suppose. But that's stupid, isn't it? We're here at the beginning of something sublime, just the way Tay promised. Light coming into the world from a place we never even dreamed existed. It's the birth of the unconquered sun, isn't it? Oh, the suns are going to be fine, Jude said. They usually are. But you're not so sure about the daughters?
No, I'm not, she said.
Hapeximendios killed the goddesses throughout the Imagica, Clem. Or at least tried to. Now I find he's Gentle's father. That doesn't make me feel too comfortable about doing his work.
I can understand that.
Part of me thinks...
She let her voice trail into the silence, the thought unfinished.
What? He asked. Tell me.
Part of me thinks we're fools to trust either of them, Hapeximendios or his reconciler. If he was such a loving god, why did he do so much harm? And don't tell me he moves in mysterious ways, because that's so much horse shit and we both know it.
Have you talked to Gentle about this?
I've tried, but he's got one thing on his mind.
Two, Clem said.
The reconciliation's one, Pi O Pa's the other.
Oh, yes. The glorious Pi O Pa.
Did you know he married it?
Yes, he told me.
It must have been quite a creature.
I'm a little biased, I'm afraid, she said dryly. It tried to kill me.
Gentle said that wasn't Pi's nature.
No.
He told me he ordered it to live its life as an assassin or a whore. It's all his fault, he said. He blames himself for everything.
Does he blame himself, or does he just take responsibility? She said. There's a difference.
I don't know, Clem said, unwilling to be drawn on such niceties. He's certainly lost without Pi.
She kept her counsel here, wanting to say that she too was lost, that she too pined, but not trusting even Clem with this admission.
He told me Pi's spirit is still alive, like Tay's, Clem was saying. And when this is all over, he says a lot of things.
Jude cut in, weary of hearing Gentle's wisdoms repeated.
And you don't believe him?
What do I know? She said, flinty now.
I don't belong in this gospel. I'm not his lover, and I won't be his disciple.
A sound behind them, and they turned to find Gentle standing in the hallway, the brightness bouncing up from the step like footlights. There was sweat on his face, and his shirt was stuck to his chest. Clem rose with guilty speed, his heel catching his bottle. It rolled down two steps, spilling frothy beer as it went, before Jude caught it.
It's hot up there, Gentle said. And it's not getting any cooler, Clem observed. Can I have a word?
Jude knew he wanted to speak out of her earshot, but Clem was either too guileless to realize this, which she doubted, or unwilling to play his game. He stayed on the step, obliging Gentle to come to the door.
When Monday gets back, he said, I'd like you to go to the estate and bring back the stones in the retreat. I'm going to perform the reconciliation upstairs, where I've got my memories to help me.
Why are you sending Clem? Jude said, not rising or even turning. I know the way. He doesn't. I know what the stones look like. He doesn't.
I think you'd be better off here. Gentle replied.
Now she turned.
What for? She said. I'm no use to anyone. Unless you simply want to keep an eye on me.
Not at all.
Then let me go, she said. I'll take Monday to help me. Clem and Tay can stay here. They're your angels, aren't they?
If that's the way you prefer it, he said, I don't mind.
I'll come back. Don't worry,
she said derisively, raising her beer bottle.
If it's only to toast the miracle.
3.
A little while after this conversation, with a blue tide of dusk rising in the street and lifting the day to the rooftops, Gentle left off his debates with Pye and went to sit with Celestine. Her room was more meditative than the one he'd left. Where the memories of Pye had become so easy to conjure, it was sometimes hard to believe the mischief wasn't there in the flesh. Clem had lit candles beside the mattress upon which Celestine was sleeping, and their light showed Gentle a woman so deeply asleep that no dreams troubled her. Though she was far from emaciated, her features were stark, as though her flesh was halfway to becoming bone. He studied her for a time, wondering if his own face would one day possess such severity. Then he returned to the wall at the bottom of the bed and sat on his haunches there, listening to the slow cadence of her breath. His mind was reeling with all that he'd learned or recollected in the room above. Like so much of the magic he'd become acquainted with, the working of the reconciliation was not a great ceremonial. Whereas most of the dominant religions of the Fifth wallowed in ritual in order to blind their flocks to the paucity of their understanding, the liturgies and requiems, charts and sacraments, all created to amplify those tiny grains of comprehension the holy men actually possessed. Such theatrics were redundant when the ministers had truth in their grasp, and with the help of memory, he might yet become one such minister. The principle of the reconciliation was not very difficult to grasp, he'd discovered. Every 200 years, it seemed, the Innovo produced a kind of blossom, a five-petaled lotus, which floated for a brief time in those lethal waters, immune to either their poison or their inhabitants. This sanctuary was called by a variety of names, but most simply and most often, the Anna. In it, the maestros would gather, carrying their analogues of the dominions they each represented. Once the pieces were assembled, the process had its own momentum. The analogues would fuse, and empowered by the Anna, burgeon, driving the Innovo back and opening the way between the reconciled dominions and the Fifth. "The flow of things is towards success," the mischief had said, speaking from a better time. "It's the natural instinct of every broken thing to make itself whole, and the Imagica is broken until it's reconciled." "Then why have there been so many failures?" Gentle had asked. "There haven't been that many," Pye had replied, "and they were always destroyed by outside forces. Christos was brought down by politics. Pineo was destroyed by the Vatican. Always people from the outside, destroying the maestro's best intentions. We don't have such enemies."
Ironic words, with hindsight. Gentle could not afford such complacency again, not with Sartori still alive and the chilling image of Pye's last frantic appearance at the Erasure still in his head. It was no use dwelling on it. He put the sight away as best he could, settling his gaze on Celestine instead. It was difficult to think of her as his mother. Maybe, among the innumerable memories he'd garnered in this house, there was some faint recollection of being a babe in these arms, of putting his toothless mouth to these breasts and being nourished there. But if it was there, it escaped him. Perhaps there were simply too many years, and lives, and women, between now and that cradling. He could find it in him to be grateful for the life she'd given him, but it was hard to feel much more than that. After a time, the vigil began to depress him. She was too like a corpse, lying there, and he too much a dutiful but loveless mourner. He got up to go, but before he quit the room, he halted at her bedside and stooped to touch her cheek. He'd not laid his flesh to hers in 23 or 24 decades, and perhaps after this he wouldn't do so again. She wasn't chilly, as he'd expected her to be, but warm, and he kept his hand upon her longer than he'd intended. Somewhere in the depths of her slumber she felt his touch, and seemed to rise into a dream of him. Her austerity softened, and her pale lips said, "Child." He wasn't sure whether to answer, but in the moment of hesitation she spoke again, the same question. This time he replied.
"Yes, Mama," he said.
"Will you remember what I told you?"
"What now?" he wondered. I'm not certain, he told her. I'll try.
Shall I tell you again? I want you to remember, child.
Yes, Mama, he said. That will be good. Tell me again.
She smiled an infinitesimal smile and began to repeat a story she'd apparently told many times.
There was a woman once called Nisi Nirvana.
She'd no sooner started, however, than the dream she was having lost its claim on her, and she began to slip back into a deeper place, her voice losing power as she went.
Don't stop, Mama, Gentle prompted. I want to hear. There was a woman.
Yes.
Called Nisi Nirvana.
Yes. And she went to a city full of iniquities, where no ghost was holy and no flesh was whole. And something there did a great hurt to her.
Her voice was getting stronger again, but the smile, even that tiniest hint, had gone.
What hurt was this, Mama?
You needn't know the hurt, child. You'll learn about it one day, and on that day you'll wish you could forget it. Just understand that it's a hurt only men can do to women.
And who did this hurt to her? Gentle asked.
I told you, child. A man.
But what man?
His name doesn't matter. What matters is that she escaped him, and came back into her own city, and knew she must make a good thing from this bad that had been done to her. And do you know what that good thing was?
No, Mama.
It was a little baby. A perfect little baby. And she loved it so much it grew big after a time. And she knew it would be leaving her, so she said, I have a story to tell you before you go. And do you know what the story was? I want you to remember, child.
Tell me.
There was a woman called Nisi Nirvana, and she went into a city of iniquities.
That's the same story, Mama.
Where no ghost was holy.
You haven't finished the first story. You've just begun again.
And no flesh was whole. And something there.
Stop, Mama,
Gentle said.
Stop.
Did a great hurt to her.
Distressed by this loop, Gentle took his hand from his mother's cheek. She didn't halt her recitation, however, at least not at first. The story went on exactly as it had before. The escape from the city, the good thing made from the bad, the baby, the perfect little baby. But with the hand no longer on her cheek, Celestine was sinking back into unthinking slumber, her voice steadily growing more indistinct. Gentle got up and backed away to the door, as the whispered wheel came full circle again.
So she said, I have a story to tell you before you go.
Gentle reached behind him and opened the door, his eyes fixed on his mother as the words slurred.
And do you know what the story was?
She said.
I want you to remember, child.
He went on watching her as he slipped out into the hallway. The last sounds he heard would have been nonsense to any ear other than this, but he'd heard this story often enough now to know that she was beginning again, as she dropped into dreamlessness.
There was a woman once.
On that, he closed the door. For some inexplicable reason, he was shaking, and had to stand at the threshold for several seconds before he could control the tremor. When he turned, he found Clem at the bottom of the stairs, sorting through a selection of candles.
Is she still asleep?
He asked as Gentle approached.
Yes. Has she talked to you at all, Clem?
Very little. Why?
I've just been listening to her tell a story in her sleep. Something about a woman called Nisi Nirvana. Do you know what that means?
Nisi Nirvana? Unless heaven. Is that somebody's name?
Apparently. And it must mean a lot to her for some reason. That's the name she sent Jude with to fetch me.
And what's the story?
Damn strange, Gentle said.
Maybe you liked it better when you were a kid.
Maybe.
If I hear her talking again, do you want me to call you down?
I don't think so, Gentle said. I've got it by heart already.
He started up the stairs.
You're going to need some candles up there, Clem said, and matches to light 'em with.
So I am, Gentle said, turning back.
Clem handed over half a dozen candles, thick, stubby and white. Gentle handed one of them back.
5's the magic number, he said.
I left some food at the top of the stairs, Clem said as Gentle started to climb again. It's not exactly haute cuisine, but it's sustenance, and if you don't claim it now, it'll be gone as soon as the boy gets back.
Gentle called his thanks back down the flight, picked up the bread, strawberries, and bottle of beer waiting at the top, then returned to the meditation room, closing the door behind him. Perhaps because he was still preoccupied with what he'd heard from his mother's lips, the memories of Pi were not waiting at the threshold. The room was empty, a cell of the present. It wasn't until Gentle had set the candles on the mantelpiece and was lighting one of them that he heard the mischief speaking softly behind him.
"Now I've distressed you," it said.
Gentle turned into the room and found the mischief at the window where it so often loitered, with a look of deep concern on its face.
"I shouldn't have asked," Pi went on. "It's just idle curiosity. I heard Abe Love asking the boy Lucius a day or two ago, and it made me wonder."
"What did Lucius say?"
"He said he remembered being suckled. That was the first thing he could recall, the teat at his mouth."
Only now did Gentle grasp the subject under debate here. Once again his memory had found some fragment of conversation between himself and the mischief pertinent to his present concerns. They'd talked of childhood memories in this very room, and the maestro had been plunged into the same distress which he felt now, and for the same reason.
"But to remember a story," Pi was saying, "particularly one you didn't like."
"It wasn't that I didn't like it," the maestro said. "At least, it didn't frighten me the way a ghost story might have done. It was worse than that."
"We don't have to talk about this," Pi said.
And for a moment Gentle thought the conversation was going to fizzle out there. He wasn't altogether certain he'd have minded if it had, but it seemed to have been one of the unwritten rules of this house that no inquiry was ever fled from, however discomforting.
"Now, I want to explain if I can," the maestro said, "though what a child fears is sometimes hard to fathom."
"Unless we can listen with a child's heart," Pi said.
"That's harder still."
"We can't try, can't we? Tell me the story."
"Well, it always began the same way. My mother would say, 'I want you to remember, child,' and I'd know right away what was going to follow. There was a woman called Nisi Novana, and she went into a city full of iniquities."
Now Gentle heard the story again, this time from his own lips, told to the mischief. The woman, the city, the crime, the child, and then, with a sickening inevitability, the story beginning again with the woman and the city and the crime.
"Rape isn't a very pretty subject for a nursery tale," Pi observed.
"She never used that word."
"But that's what the crime is, isn't it?"
"Yes,"
he said softly, though he was uncomfortable with the admission. This was his mother's secret, his mother's pain. But yes, of course, Nisi Nirvana was Celestine, and the City of Terrors was the first dominion. She told her child her own